From the studios of KUSP in Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. New York Times bestselling author Jonathan Jordan is my guest. His books include Lone Star Navy, Texas, The Fight for the Gulf of Mexico and the Shaping of the American West, Brothers, Rivals, Victors, Eisenhower, Patton, Bradley, and the Partnership that Drove the Allied Conquest in Europe. His latest book is American Warlords, How Roosevelt's High Command Led America to Victory in World War II. Jonathan Jordan, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you very much, Gary.
You know, it's hard to believe, but most of the generation who fought in World War II are gone now. The youngest soldiers would be in their 90s. So how does today's perception of World War II differ from the reality of World War II?
Well, we look back through a kind of distorted lens, through a glass darkly, as it were. We tend to think in terms of those images that stick with us. We see Iwo Jima and the Marines raising the flag, Rosie the Riveter. We think of big waves of bombers, but those bombers had to be built someplace, and they had to be built from a country that was recovering from a depression. Those Marines on Iwo Jima had to be recruited in a military that had been stripped down to almost nothing during the Great Depression. So the four men in American Warlords, President Roosevelt and his three top military advisors, had a lot of work to do to get us there.
Well, how did Americans in 1940 feel about the war in Europe? Were they ambivalent about it? Were they definitely, we don't want to have anything to do with it? Or were they gung-ho, yeah, let's go fight Hitler?
You know, throughout the year 1940, there was a change in the American electorate. 1939 was a year that looked like Britain, Germany, France, and the rest were just going to get into another stupid European war. One of the big hit songs for that year was a takeoff of the song Over There called Let Them Keep It Over There. And that reflected the way many Americans felt. And Roosevelt, being a politician, had to deal with that as a reality of the political landscape. But the fall of France in the spring of 1940 shocked America. It shocked Roosevelt. And we realized that the Western democracies were not going to be able to contain Hitler. America was going to get into the fight one way or another, Roosevelt believed, and it was a question of how Roosevelt could lead America down that path to war without scaring the public into thinking that he was trying to rush into something that they didn't believe or weren't fully convinced was right.
Now, what about in the Pacific? Were Americans even aware that Japan had invaded Manchuria? Or did they care? What was the attitude?
Gary, at the top level, I think people did care. People like Henry Stimson, one of the characters in this in American Warlords, was passionate about what the Japanese were doing to the Chinese. He was passionate about trying to eliminate or at least contain Japanese expansion. But remember, this is a part of the world that even today people have difficulty with the geography, the vastness of the ocean, the vastness of the Eurasian landmass, and the geography of what the strategic points were was something that escaped many Americans. And Roosevelt, for his part, was focused principally on Germany as the main enemy since the time that both men took power, which was at the beginning of 1933. FDR had seen Nazism as a threat to America, and that was the foe he wanted to focus on.
But he was interested in stopping Japan for some reason, right?
Oh, he certainly was. He could look by the end of 1940 and see the world coming apart on both ends. Japan, of course, was economically, it's an island nation, and it was economically dependent upon the United States. But Japan was gripped by the same kind of militarism that was gripping Italy and Germany at the time. So Roosevelt believed that Japan had to be contained. On the other hand, he knew that he did not have the navy or the army to fight both enemies. So his strategy was to keep Japan quiet if he could in the Pacific and essentially goad Germany into war by late 1941.
So that brings up the question that, you know, people have speculated over the years that FDR knew in advance of Pearl Harbor and allowed it to happen so that he could goad Germany into declaring war.
Well, Roosevelt wanted to get into war, but he didn't want to get into war with Japan. That was the wrong strategic approach for him. I don't believe there's any really credible evidence that Roosevelt either knew about a specific attack against Pearl Harbor. He did know that Japan was about to go to war with America. Unfortunately, late November, Thanksgiving of 1941, we knew the Japanese were going to do something. But at the time, Roosevelt and his advisors had their eyes fixed on Southeast Asia, basically rounding the bend or near Cameron Bay in Vietnam. They saw the Japanese heading over toward Burma and Singapore. They thought that was where the war was going to break out because that was where Japan's resources were.
When the United States was pursuing its goal of manifest destiny, Americans swept across North America, conquering all who stood in their way. How did America's conquest differ from Japan's goals?
Ideologically, it was not much different from what the Western powers and what the United States had done in their spheres of influence. Japan in 1940 coveted the same kind of empires that Western Europe had in 1900, but they did it on a vast scale. They did it on a brutal scale, and they didn't realize that the time of naked territorial conquest with the sword had come and gone. It had come and gone for the Western European democracies, who had now taken on the role of just balancing power throughout the globe.
So, in other words, if they had done it 100 years earlier, nobody would have noticed.
I don't know that I'd say no one would have noticed a massacre on the scale of the rape of Nanking, for instance.
Yeah.
But I do think that it's something that would have been looked at very differently by the Western powers.
Now, just skipping ahead for a minute, there was something in your book that made me think of a question. When I can't remember who says it, but in the lead up to the atomic bomb in Japan, someone expressed concern that America would surpass Germany in brutality. And that made me wonder...
Right, General Marshall, correct.
Right, and that made me wonder, when exactly did Roosevelt know about the depth of Nazi brutality? When did he know that there were death camps and so forth?
Roosevelt had known for a long time that there was serious brutality being used, against the Jews, and that was probably the more widely publicized group. But of course, there were many, many other groups as well: gypsies, homosexuals, communists, dissidents, and others who were victims of Nazi brutality. Roosevelt had known at different points during the war that there was butchery going on, and the exact form was arguably murky for a while, but we knew there were death camps out there. We knew, certainly by 1943, we knew where these death camps were. Roosevelt had convinced Stalin and Churchill to go along with him on a declaration condemning the German butchery of the Jews. And so we knew that there were these horrific atrocities going on.
We're chatting with Jonathan W. Jordan. His new book is called American Warlords: How Roosevelt's High Command Led America to Victory in World War II. I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf. It's a fascinating book, and it took me a long time to digest it all. But at the same time, I wonder, what were you... You know, when you use the word warlords, that's a powerful word. We don't usually associate that word with American leadership.
You know, Gary, this was the American way of war. And one theme you see throughout the book is that these four men were at the center of the decisions, but they could never make the decisions on their own. Roosevelt came the closest to being a genuine warlord because he had almost unprecedented power over the American economy, over the American consumer, over the American soldier. He was the closest to it, but what you see is that American warlords are different, or were different at the time, from say, the Stalins or the Hitlers or even the Churchills, because there were so many different political sides to what they had to do. If Roosevelt wanted to create a shipbuilding program, he had to go to Congress to get the appropriations for it. He had to go to the business community and reach out to people who were his political enemies for so many years during his New Deal era, and get them on board with the idea that we need to start converting production to things like ships, tanks, and planes as opposed to consumer goods or clothing or cornbread or tractors or and so on.
And how did he do that?
He worked incrementally. Roosevelt was one of the big complaints about Roosevelt by his generals was that he never would strike out and take a decisive leadership position. With the draft, he didn't do it. With the extension of the draft, he didn't do it. He was a cautious guy. But as a cautious guy, he also had a very good sense for what the American public would do, and he would speak to them through fireside chats, through speeches to Congress. He kept repeating the theme over and over until, as he saw it, the American public became convinced this was the right thing to do. And his view was that the public can take any amount of knocks on the chin, as he put it, if they believe in what they're fighting for, and they can overcome any obstacles. His view was, we got through the Depression because we all believed that the New Deal programs were the right way to go about it. And if I just tell the American public why we're fighting, and they believe the answers are good ones, they'll overcome the greatest threat to freedom in almost all of human history.
You know, we're in the early summer of 2015, and the presidential election is already, you know, in full swing. And it made me wonder, when did President Roosevelt decide that he would run for a third term, and how was he able to campaign for a third term, which must have been a huge thing, and continue to do all these things?
It was. As to when he decided on a third term, he kept his cards very close to his vest. I don't think many people in the White House really knew. But the best answer, as historians, we can come up with is that by the time we got to the early summer of 1940, and we saw the British and the French driven off the continent at Dunkirk, the Blitzkrieg began opening up on London. At that point, Roosevelt believed that this was a crisis of sufficient proportion that he couldn't simply vacate the director's chair and let somebody else take it over. The way he put it to himself, I think the way he rationalized it and the way he sold it to the American public was, as commander-in-chief of the Army and Navy, I don't have any more right to leave my post than a private does if we're in an emergency. I'm going to be asking people to serve their country in uniform, and I just can't tell everybody I'm going off to retirement while you fight my war. Of course, Roosevelt loved power as well, so it certainly coincided with his gut feeling, too.
Which leads to the 1944, when he ran again. And did he have any inkling that he was ill, that he wouldn't serve out his term?
Roosevelt never made a concession to his physical or political mortality. He would not ask too many questions of his doctors. He knew that he was not feeling well, but as he saw it, he could get through pretty much anything he set his mind to. He had a job to finish, creating a United Nations, winning the war. These were big things that were on his plate. After the war, Eleanor said that she thought that if he knew that working through a fourth term would kill him, that he probably would do it anyway, because he felt like this is what he was supposed to do for his country.
Because I loved the part in your book when suddenly Truman is president. I mean, he really didn't have much of an inkling of what was. He didn't know anything about the atomic bomb, for instance, right?
He knew very little about what was going on. Roosevelt, like I said, kept his cards close to his vest. He referred to himself as the juggler. He said, I never let my right hand know what my left hand is doing. And that was the way he ran his government. Unlike today, where you have rapid communications, governmental computer systems are wired to each other. Back then, Roosevelt ran a very personal government, and it gave his generals and his military advisors fits that he would talk to people and then not get the word around about what he was thinking. The Joint Chiefs of Staff was really just a mechanism set up so the men running the war could find out what their commander-in-chief was thinking and what he wanted.
Jonathan Jordan, can you tell us a little bit about the impact of Roosevelt's insistence on unconditional surrender? What did he mean, and why was that a huge problem?
Unconditional surrender, the way Roosevelt first announced it at the Casablanca Conference in 1943, meant, as he put it, the end of militarism, the end of the philosophy of conquest in the German people, the Italian people, and the Japanese people. He said, I'm not going to destroy the people themselves. We don't want to do that, but we do want to rid them of their mentality. He later put it this way. He said, those countries, after unconditional surrender, will be permitted to join the ranks of other nations again, but it's going to be a long uphill climb, and we're going to see to it that they're not burdened in that uphill climb by having to carry guns around. This unconditional surrender gave his military men fits for two reasons. First, he sprang it on them without really asking them about it. And second, as he knew and as they knew, that was going to make the Germans and the Italians and the Japanese fight much harder. If they believed that the only alternative was lay down their arms and take whatever the Russians and take whatever the Western allies were going to give them, then that was, of course, a propaganda boon to Joseph Goebbels and others in the German high command.
So when Roosevelt died and Truman came in, I had always heard, and this was kind of different from the story you tell in your book, that Truman considered many options with the atomic bomb. But in your book, it seems like he never considered anything other than dropping the atomic bomb on Japan.
The person who was really running the atomic bomb project from the top, for the most part, was Henry Stimson, the Secretary of War. Stimson had set up a committee, and he asked Truman for permission to do it, to talk about different ways to use the atomic bomb. They considered a lot of different things. Do we give Japan a warning? Do we drop the bomb on an unpopulated area? What do we do? But by the time it got up to Truman's level, the first question he discussed was, do we use the bomb or not? We know we think we're going to have to invade. We know we're going to invade the southern island of Kyushu in Japan, but do we want to try the atomic bomb first? And once that decision was made, other questions about which targets to use and the manner of using it, he pretty much left to the next level down.
So he ultimately didn't consider it then.
He didn't consider it much. Now, the committee that Truman set up created a report with their recommendations, and of course he saw that. So he didn't talk about it very much. He pretty much went along with what that committee's recommendation was, which was, let's not give Japan a specific warning. We don't want to tell them where we're going to drop it. They might move American prisoners there. And if the thing is a dud, we don't want to tell them we've got a war-winning weapon here, and then find out that it's just egg on our face.
And another thing I learned in American Warlords was that the two bombs that were dropped, one on Hiroshima, the other on Nagasaki, were different kinds of bombs and that they worked in different ways. Were they anxious to test them both, and therefore that's why they dropped the second one?
You know, that's an interesting question, Gary. First bomb, called the Little Boy, was a rather simple, as atomic bombs go, simple mechanism. They didn't feel they needed to test that one. They were pretty sure from their theoretical physics models that it would work. The plutonium bomb, called the Fat Man, worked in a different way. It involved a very complex sequence of triggers and explosives to basically take a big ball and squish it into a tiny ball. And that was the one that they tested at Los Alamos, or a Trinity site. rather. And so that was one that they used for the second atomic bombing on Nagasaki.
So do you think that they really wanted to try that second one?
They wanted to, that was the second one they had, and that was it wasn't that we wanted to test it over Japan on a military target. They'd already tested it and they knew what it would do. They did want to find a way to make as big a shock impact as possible, and for that reason they dropped it on a military target, but they specified that the target had to be highly populated. So the idea being that the Japanese government could not simply cover it up as an earthquake or something. And they also specified that it needed to be in an area with hills surrounding it to maximize the blast impact, a few other military considerations like that. But the idea at the time, from everything Truman talked about with his advisors, was how do we win the war fastest? If this is a way to do it, let's try it.
Was there any talk about, and also we want Stalin to see that we have this thing?
They didn't talk about it in the context of Japan, although that was a military talk. Truman, of course, brought that weapon up at the Potsdam conference when he met with Stalin. And it was interesting when the two men met. Stalin was walking, I believe, in a hallway, and Truman had mentioned kind of casually that we've got this new weapon that is going to devastate Japan. And Stalin just sort of looked like he didn't really know what Truman was talking about. And he said, well, I hope you use it to the best advantage, and kind of moved on and left all the Americans wondering, does he even know what we mean by this? But actually he had. He had spies in the American A-bomb complex for a long time. Klaus Fuchs was one who had been sending thousands of pages of Manhattan Project information over to Moscow, and he knew about the atomic bomb test. So it was something that both Truman and Stalin danced around. Truman felt that the possession of the atomic bomb would give him a stronger hand when dealing with Stalin and Eastern Europe.
This is a great read, by the way, this book, American Warlords. It reads like a novel, like a thriller.
Oh, thank you.
But so when you dove in, I mean, I imagine you had a whole lot of knowledge. But what, if anything, what did you learn that you didn't know before when you wrote this book?
Gosh, the American war effort was a true total war effort. One person put it like this. He said, Roosevelt was really the only one who understood total war. And to Roosevelt, total war meant we're going to get the housewife. We're going to have the children who can do scrap aluminum drives. We're going to have Boy Scouts. We're going to have the guy on the factory line. It's not just about soldiers and bombs and things that go boom. The war effort has to be something that we all can get behind. And Roosevelt never ceased to involve all aspects of the country as much as he could in the objective of winning the war. It's kind of interesting because we think of Hitler as being the total war fanatic, but Hitler did not have Roosevelt's understanding of how all areas of society work together for a particular goal. He saw the home front as being an extension of the battlefront. And the way he brought so many disparate parts of America's economy and society together and focused them on the objective of defeating Hitler, Mussolini, and Hirohito was quite remarkable.
It was interesting because it's not that long ago, really, but you know, when you think about how the most recent wars have been fought, Americans go about their daily lives without even knowing there's a war going on.
Absolutely, Gary. That's with the war on terror, it's an optional war. The most that the ordinary citizen has to do is take their shoes off when they go through an airport. There may be a few inconveniences here and there, but if you don't want to participate, you don't have to. And that is very different in many ways from what Franklin Roosevelt had during the Second War. The challenge during the Second World War was great, but the unity of focus the country had was also great.
Well, it's a brilliant book. It's called American Warlords, How Roosevelt's High Command Led America to Victory in World War II. And the author, my guest, Jonathan W. Jordan. Thank you so much for spending some time with us on From the Bookshelf.
Gary, it's been my pleasure.
Well, that's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you had a good time, and we'll come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to the podcast at iTunes, and you can like us on Facebook. I want to thank my guest, Jonathan W. Jordan. His book is called American Warlords, How Roosevelt's High Command Led America to Victory in World War II. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for listening. See you next time.